Yo, here we are back for as our 54th episode.
God, how time flies, brother.
54th episode of Powers and Principalities. So tonight, I think we agreed to talk about the Rockefellers, the Rockefeller family. They're an American industrial political banking family. They reportedly owned one of the world's largest fortunes. The fortune was made initially in, U.S. Petroleum. Then they moved into banking and finance and everything else, I guess you could say. But during the late and early 20th century, John D. Rockefeller and his brother William Rockefeller amassed a great fortune primarily through Standard Oil. The family is also known for its long association with Chase Manhattan Bank. The Rockefellers are also considered to be one of the most powerful families, if not the most powerful family in the history of the United States. John D. Rockefeller, getting his start in Cleveland in the 1860s, incorporated Standard Oil and grew into a mammoth oil refining industry. By 1880, Standard Oil was responsible for refining between 90-95% of all the oil in America. By eliminating the competition, arranging mergers with rivals, and offering generous incentives to the railroad industry, Standard Oil became a dominant power that eventually created a monopoly. In 1906, the U.S. government brought suit against Standard Oil under the Sherman Antitrust Act of 1890, and in 1911, the company was forced to divest all of its major holdings, 33 companies in all. And that was the end of the Rockefellers. John D. Rockefeller retired, and the Rockefellers never heard from them ever again. No, just kidding. He became, of course, in fact, he became wealthier by breaking up because the various companies were worth more than the Standard Oil Corporation. So actually, that decision made him wealthier. As Standard Oil was broken up, it became well-known companies. I think named Exxon, Esso. Sohio, these other various names that broke up. He was America's first billionaire, reportedly. So that's how the Rockefellers got their start. Of course, there's an interesting story before that with his father, William Rockefeller. So you want to get into that? What's your take on that? That's kind of a brief history of the Rockefellers. And, you know,
good summation, you know, for sure. Well, the family is just steeped in, their background is just steeped in mystery. Very difficult to get good data on them. And I wonder if it hasn't been somehow scrubbed. Hard really to know about their background. There are people who say that the Rockefellers are Jewish, that the family basically came from Turkey, and then from there to France and on to the United States. And if that trajectory can be confirmed, and I wasn't able to do it, then it would definitely indicate that they're Murano, because at that time, Turkey was gathering in Muranos. And then they were also, at the time when the Rockefeller family is purportedly leaving, would be also when there was a dispersion of the Muranos, you know, from the Middle East into Europe and in the United States. So that would be kind of confirming, or at least supporting evidence for that proclamation. There's the famous John D. He's the one who's most known. He's kind of the original oligarch. Okay, so he's really the American in some way. I mean, obviously there were the Rothschilds, but kind of the first homegrown oligarch. There really isn't anyone before him that was able to so completely dominate things politically, and we'll go into all this before John Dee amassed all of his money. The interesting thing about the most interesting character to me, because see, when I look at the Rockefellers, I mean, obviously they're part of the secret society. I mean, we'll go into like David's statement at the Bilderberg, where he talks about the New World Order, you know, which is well corroborated. You know, we'll talk about that later on. But so the family is inside, and Tim, I'll tell you, you know. If you can get to the bottom of the Rockefellers, you would know the ins and outs of the secret society. To me, the one of the key problems we have is we don't know enough about the secret society. We can determine that it's there, but it is almost impossible to get hard data on its background because it's a secret society. Yeah. Right? They're good at keeping it hidden. And one of the things they keep hidden, I think, is ethnicity. And so if there were DNA evidence of the Rockefeller family available, and, for example, it would show that they're Murano, that they're a Jewish family, this would really be something that would enable the, you know, every man to understand the secret society. Because if the Rockefellers are in the side of the equation of the Jewish families that are inside the secret society that can be established, like the Warburgs and the Rothschilds, and okay, then you would have, if the Rockefellers were in fact Murano, then you would really have a pretty clear lineup. And then when you look at the kind of political structures they set up, basically what you'd be looking at is a kind of totally dominated Jewish world, right? And what that would mean is that, you know, you talk often about how there was the Jewish ascendancy after World War II in America and to some extent in Europe, but certainly in America. Before that, you had the WASP, you know, kind of hierarchy structure, political power, religious power. And then after that, you had, you know, you had the Jewish ascendancy. You get to see we talked about the comedians last week, you know, but certainly the banking, you know, was dominated from World War II on. But, you know, one way to look at that is that really you're looking at Masonic era. You know, we talked about how the idea of the WASP is not really reflective of the reality, because you have the secret society that has a question mark in terms of its, you know, ethnic background. I mean, I'll just give you an example. Like, you know, you have the Boston Brahmins. Now, they're reported as, you know, they were the group that did the Tea Party. They're, they have a lot of Christian connections and are seen as Gentiles. But they are Masons, you know. They are this long-standing Masonic multi-family tradition. They're very inbred, and so I would just say it's a question mark, because every time, you know, you see, in my opinion, a Christian family that has a Masonic tradition, then you have to put an asterisk by the Christianity, because, you know, you can't really be a full Christian if you're also taking swearing secret oaths. You know, in other words, if you look at Prescott and, you know, the George Bushes, well, they come across as Christians, but are they really? I mean, what is sworn in skull and bones? And are these oaths transcendent? In other words, are they the most powerful controlling force to these personalities? Because if that's the case, then, you know, particularly from the perspective of a voter, you can't really say, oh, gee, I'm going to vote for a Christian, because you have that asterisk. You know, you have the secret society. So if there is one thing we can do tonight, it's to get an enthusiastic member of the Rockefeller family to give up enough DNA so we can make these determinations. I think this would just be great. I'm not sure we'll be able to get it. But there is a number of people who link this family into Jewish background. One thing is clear is that Joffrey Rockefeller married Helen Gratz, and she it was Jewish, and so that strand of the tree, you know, is posted posts in like Jewish families in America, and that part of the family, even though it isn't you know, descended directly from John Dee, but rather from his brother, is really very important. And it's quite interesting because if you actually look into Joffrey's background, you find that he was a member of the Scroll and Key, right, which is this other Yale secret society that I think may actually be just as creepy, but it is certainly Masonic in its orientation. If you look in the many famous members, you know, who powerful people were in Scroll and Key, you also have this individual, Joffrey Rockefeller. Now, what's sort of important is that what I did was I looked into this guy's background, and it's just fascinating because he is completely entwined with Skull and Bones. If you look at like the people who attended his weddings and his first business associates, they're Skull and Bones. And then the other strand that comes into this side of the Rockefeller family are the Bushes. This is actually quite interesting because it's where I think you have this direct relationship between the Bush family and, and political power. Because if you look at Joffrey Rockefeller's, like the people who were at his wedding and the people who had, you'll see that Prescott Bush's wife was very close with Helen Gratz, and that the two of them were also involved in a lot of foundation work together. They were in this thing called the Research in Schizophrenia, which is kind of a creepy because in a few iterations, it sort of becomes MK Ultra.
Yeah.
But so that's, you know, this relationship, this kind of plugging into secret society through that side of the Rockefeller family, I think is, you know, is very interesting. And I wanted to close with just this one little thing, which I thought was just, I'm sure you know this, but I didn't, and I was just quite shocked by it. You know, in Andover, you know, you have this time the Yale Secret Society. You've got Joffrey Rockefeller. Now, he also was on the staff of the Yale University that went to China. Mm-hmm. And you'll never guess who one of his staff members were. Mao Tse-sung.
Yeah, I know that he was Mao was a Yalie.
Mao was a Yalie, yeah. But not only that, he was plugged into the whole Andover secret society world with Joffrey Rockefeller.
Yeah, and he had OSS handlers too. And
yeah, so you can see just how well organized.
I think his OSS handler's name was Snowden, which I thought was interesting.
That was it really? Oh, that's
if I recall properly, yeah, correctly. Yeah.
But anyway, so this is kind of like the, you know, just the first thing I want to put out there is that I would really like to get to the bottom of the Rockefellers' genealogy. I think this would be a really valuable thing to know, because if it could be proven one way or another, it would really give us a strong way of understanding the secret society. Because one of the theories that has been presented to me many times is that it is just kind of power and money, and there are a lot of Jewish families in it, but they have merged with, Gentile families to form this overarching kind of secular secret society. That would be one reality. The other is that what you saw when, you know, you have the Jewish ascendancy is just the shadow of Masonry was lifted and people could come out, you know, and that Masonry was really, kind of a way of keeping hidden a Jewish ethnicity, right? So if that theory is correct, then you look at the Rockefellers and they a way to try to determine the strength of the two theories would be to find out, well, what is the background of the Rockefellers?
Yeah.
And so I mean, I don't, I've looked at it and it seems pretty good in terms of there being Gentiles. Because you have, you know, on both sides of John Dee's family going back, you for at least for 4 or 5 generations, you have people that apparently are Gentile. So it's, but at the same time, you also have longstanding sort of secret society families that I think the ethnicity is a question mark, and they're certainly plugged into secret society like the Bush family. So this would be something I think would really be useful for people to know, and hopefully we can create some interest in this in our little discussion tonight, Tim, because the Rockefeller family is pretty big. A lot of people in it, and including some people, I think, that are not, you know, completely fine with the family, that have some, at least express some a little, you know, questioning of the power, political application of the family's power. And so they might be willing to say, hey, I'm up for that. Contact me, Joe Atwell, or Tim Kelly, what would be power or principality. So contact one of us and let's get to the bottom of this. But anyway, that's my take on the Rockefellers. They are fascinating, evil as rattlesnakes, as far as I can tell. And, you know, just looking going forward in terms of how they applied power. But that's further in our discussion.
Yeah, this discovering the secret of their success. Could it be genealogical, some sort of connection? I do. It's interesting because Rockefeller, much of the reason or how he was able to dominate oil refining was through these deals with railroads. And he was able to negotiate a discounted, because at that time, I think oil was transported via rail. And he was able to negotiate volume discounts. At least that's how the story goes. And that's what the reason why he was able to come to dominate the industry. Now, of course, the question is, who controlled the railroads ultimately? It's funny you point there to the railroads. And that was sort of the beginning of the American oligarchy, was through the railroads, which was a political operation. You know, the destruction of the railroads, these things were political. But the family like the Harrimans. And, of course, that's also the avenue that the Bush family took to gain wealth and power was through the railroads originally. Then they got into intelligence and oil and these things. And the development or maturation of the American intelligence community was all around banking and big oil. And of course, that's the Rockefellers, and they're the ones that formed, you know, this the OSS, which eventually became CIA. But that all came out of Yale and Wall Street and that community, and it reflected their interests and their values. But going back further into the Rockefellers, of course, we get a kind of a look in into what type of people we're talking about is by his father, William Avery Rockefeller. Some people knew him as Devil Bill. He also went by the name Dr. Livingston.
Yeah.
He was an alleged rapist, philanderer, bigamist, con man. He used to like imitate. I mean, reportedly, he would go into town, act like he was deaf, and get money from people. He literally was a snake oil salesman. I think he sold some sort of concoction that was a oil mixed with laxative or something, and apparently it was supposed to cure cancer, get rid of warts. Some of these cure all tonics. And so he literally was a snake oil salesman, petroleum based, reportedly loaned John D. Rockefeller $1,000 to start Standard Oil, and the rest is history. You have, of course, I mentioned in the intro that, you know, Standard Oil was reportedly broken up in 1911 under the Sherman Antitrust Act, but then he broke up in these other companies, which Rockefeller ended up controlling the stock behind the scenes, or just made him more money. But the Rockefellers themselves, they sort of they went into banking, and sort of with the money they earned from from Standard Oil or from their royal fortune, went into banking, then went into politics and these things. They started, you know, they also got into philanthropy and, of course, with the famous Rockefeller Foundation. And so did many other wealthy families. You know, you have, of course, you have the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Later on, you have the Ford Foundation, these things, these outfits, these tax-exempt foundations, which would really, some people say, sort of function as sort of a shadow government, particularly with the Rockefeller Foundation, the formation of the Council on Foreign Relations, because it was really the Rockefeller Foundation created the post-war State Department, you know, with the War and Peace Studies that they did in 1939 and their plan for post-war Europe. The CFR is the one that developed the Marshall Plan. It wasn't General Marshall's idea. They just put the name on it. And, of course, the CFR is endowed with the Rockefeller money oil. And, of course, CFR traces it, itself back to 1921-22. It was created pretty much the same time that the Royal Institute of International Affairs was established in Great Britain, which gets us back to the Rhodes Trust. Of course, Cecil Rhodes was ultimately financed by which family?
Well, I mean, he ends up giving all his money to the Rothschilds.
Well, he
took money from the Rockefellers when he was...
I guess they needed it.
Yeah, they were broke. I think CFR is an important kind of way to sort of understand the how important it is to get to the bottom of the Rockefellers. I really think that they are like the central question in trying to understand America. And it's frustrating that there isn't better ways of knowing about them. But the CFR is so powerful, right, inside of America policy. If you look at its members, it's just shocking, you know, like how much it controls. Hillary Clinton referred to it as the mothership. And so it seems to organize a lot of American sort of military and political and financial world. It kind of orchestrates it all. But the Rockefellers were really in back of it originally. They were some of the big money to support it. So the question is, well, why? What is, you know, what motivates the Rockefellers? Is it, I don't think it's the acquisition of more money. They're really just about power. Another organization that the Rockefellers are big into is Bilderberg. Mm-hmm. There's a famous and very well cited. It isn't. It's not nonsense. It's completely correct. There was a speech by David Rockefeller where, you know, he just blatantly talks about how it's time to, you know, to finish up the establishment of the New World Order. He uses the expression, in 1991.
Yeah. And, you have the quote?
Gosh darn it. I do, but I can't find it.
I have it.
Okay, good. Yeah. Like, read it, please.
Should I do it in David Rockefeller's voice?
God, I'd love to hear David Rockefeller.
I don't know. We are grateful to the Washington Post and New York Times, Time Magazine, and other great publications whose directors have attended our meetings and respected their promise of discretion for almost 40 years. It would have been impossible for us to develop our plan for the world if we had been subject to the bright lights of publicity during those years. But the world is now more sophisticated and prepared to march towards a world government. The supranational sovereignty of an intellectual elite and the world bankers is surely preferable to the national auto-determination practiced in past centuries. Well, okay, I was just off the cuff. I don't
know. Wow, that was like the greatest impression of David Rockefeller I've ever heard. That, I mean, literally spot on.
I've heard a lot better, but...
Well, but so, there it is. So, yeah. So he gives he's able to talk freely, you know, among his Bilderberg colleagues about where they're going. And notice he throws in the expression 40 years. I noticed that a lot of times, you know, you'll get little clues, kind of numerical clues. They'll throw in a number 40, 33, 13. Yeah. You know, it's just a way of kind of identifying sort of a perspective and and letting people know, okay, where it's coming from. But so the Rockefellers, in fact, are attempting to establish a world dictatorship, right? It's not, I mean, there's the quote, then, and everything else that their foundation.
Yeah, from his memoirs, he has some even believe we, the Rockefeller family, are part of a secret cabal working against the best interest of the United States, characterizing my family and me as internationalist and conspiring with others around the world to build a more integrated global political and economic structure. One world, if you will. If that's the charge, I stand guilty and I'm proud of it. That's page 405 of his memoirs.
So. Right. So there you have it. So that's why it's just critical to know, is it just greed and, being a psychopath that, you know, drives this family and the organization he's part of forward, or is there something else? You see, if you look at the banking system that was set up with Federal Reserve, you have basically Morgan, J.P. Morgan, who is kind of organizing the thing, and then just a whole bunch of people who are representing Jewish-controlled banks. There was really only one group that was different than that, and that's Nelson Aldrich,
mm-hmm.
who then it becomes the father-in-law of
his daughter marries,
right? And so
the son.
So but you see, if you look at the kind of the ownership of central banks, so often you see that you see Jewish names pop up. Rothschild pops up all the time, but also the Schiff family, Lehman, Warburgs. Right. You know, these names will pop up in ownership of, you know, Amsterdam, Hamburg, Berlin. Right. The mm-hmm. the Bank of New York, which is Kuhn Lum, Goldman Sachs. Right. OK, so this is well known. But Gentiles look out and they see, well, there's J.P. Morgan, but there's also the Rockefellers. Right.
Mm-hmm.
But what if Morgan and Rockefeller are Jewish? Then how does the world look? You see how important the question is?
Mm-hmm.
Is that if they are cryptos, then you're looking at basically a 100% Jewish ownership of banking. And that would, I think be something that people would be concerned about. But because you have the Morgan family and the Rockefellers, who are sort of well known as owning banks, which are related to the central banks, or in fact owned or have direct shares and ownership of the central banks, which are a central bank, you don't see it. You just see, well, it's a bunch of rich people. But that's why getting to the bottom of these people, I think is important, because Nelson Aldrich, he's a Christian guy, right? But mm-hmm. in this case, he's a huge Freemason. He actually was... he's very much recorded in the known Freemasonry as being someone who they honor for his kind of role in Freemasonry. And so you have to put that asterisk in back of Nelson Aldrich. So what is actually the glue that holds these people together, and so the Rockefellers, man, I just would like to encourage everyone who possibly can to just try to help us answer the question. If they, and I think we should try to be impartial. We shouldn't try to prejudge. I'm always concerned about this issue, but I think we should really try to just be as impartial as we can, get as much evidence assembled as is possible. And if we can find someone willing to give us some DNA, man, this would really help the process along.
Yes. With the Rockefellers, I mentioned how they amassed this huge fortune, and I guess there was Ivy Lee, the father of public relations, that Rockefeller hired. I think this was as a result of the Ludlow massacre, and he was getting a lot of bad press. You had I think it was Ida Tarbell and the McClures running a series on Rockefeller. And so he had amassed this great fortune, and although many people were in awe of him, many people hated him because he became known as sort of a very ruthless businessman. And so they started when they started. I guess the Rockefeller Foundation itself was started first as a tax dodge, but then they realized they could use it for public relations, and they started philanthropy. And philanthropy became sort of a strategy of sort of cultural and political control, because the moment they opened up, I think it was Rockefeller University, which is think of the Rockefeller Institute for Medical Research. That was largely how the Rockefellers imposed allopathic medicine on the country. I think they got this guy Abraham Flexner, who he hired to write the Flexner Report, which sought to standardize medicine in America, of course, under allopathic standards. And so that it marginalized homeopathic or naturopath care, and it created the medical doctor under licensing controlled, and conditions ultimately controlled by the Rockefellers. Because he was also able to go in and establish or take over this league of municipalities, the league of state governments, and in all the states they had laws passed that required medical licensing under conditions ultimately established by Rockefeller or men hired by Rockefeller. So much of our understanding of modern medicine has been determined by Rockefeller, whose medical doctors were trained to sell pharmaceuticals, which are ultimately derived from. from petroleum. The same thing with the ascendancy of gasoline. Rockefeller became a very strong backer of the temperance movement and the Anti-Saloon League in Ohio, I think is where it got started. But he started backing that because it was through prohibition that he was able to marginalize ethyl alcohol, which at the time was competing with gasoline. Engines at the time were designed, they could take one or the other, or at least half the engines would take vegetable-based oil, petroleum, or vegetable-based fuel, as opposed to petroleum. And the idea was, petroleum is it's hard to get. You got to refine it. It's in these strategic areas and these things. Whereas vegetable oil, you can grow anywhere, and you could, farmers could grow their own fuel. And it was just Henry Ford's idea was it was kind of established. It'd be a basis for an independent economy. Of course, that's something Rockefeller didn't want. He wanted to control and cartelize everything. The same thing he did with oil, he wanted to do to the country and indeed the world in general. What happened was through Prohibition, they were able to get a law passed that you would have to put an additive in ethyl alcohol so people wouldn't drink it. And that made it uncompetitive versus gasoline, and gasoline became ascendant. So again, that's another example of Rockefeller backing, the temperance union, sort of astroturf politics, and supporting prohibition, so he could stifle competition again through the political process. That's one of the things with the Rockefellers is they amassed his fortune through ruthless business practices. But you could say that by driving prices down and improving quality, the consumers are benefiting. At the same time, he's concentrating everything, which ultimately works against them, because the moment they concentrate wealth, then they come back and they start to take over other things and stifle competition. Through the legislative process, it's sort of political entrepreneurship as opposed to business entrepreneurship. So he's a big backer of prohibition. Of course, this also leads to the development of organized crime in America. Of course, another problem government creates and steps up to solve with the creation of the Federal Bureau of Investigation and these things. Also with the foundation, he gets into things like arts, right? The funding of the art world, and the Rockefellers are big promoters of things like modern art in these things. So they start to wage aesthetic warfare against the United States, against the Western civilization in general. The Rockefellers were big backers of modern art. I think it wasn't Abby Rockefeller who built the Museum of Modern Art in New York. And then the Rockefeller Foundation itself, I think in the 1930s, it was Johnny Rockefeller III, as a young man, started the Population Council. And they started funding, again, through philanthropy, started funding the idea of birth control and also sterilization in many respects. They were big backers of social hygiene. And, of course, these programs inspired or many of the programs that were developed in Nazi Germany in the 1930s through the Kaiser Wilhelm Institute, which was also funded by the Rockefeller Foundation. After the war, I guess eugenics got a bad name, so they had to repackage it. But then they started funding, there's all these UN programs for control. And then again in the 1960s, they get on the environmental bandwagon with the Club of Rome and these things. And one thing that you notice with all these efforts is what they're doing is they're working to limit the population. I think it's John D. Rockefeller III who was in, he was in India, and he was observing. He was in this Indian city that was teeming with people, was apparently overpopulated, a lot of poor, miserable people. And he steps off, the train in his suit, and he looks over the crowd, the teeming masses as he saw them, and looks to the people with him, and he goes, "That is the problem. Humanity is the problem." So you saw that with the Population Council, but you see that with the Club of Rome. But really, at the end of the day, you're right. It's power, and it's almost like what they want to control now is resources. It's strategic now because they control the money, as you say, right? They print the money, then charge us for the privilege of using it. So it's not just money; it's power and control of things. So now, through conservation, through environmentalism, you saw this because they're the ones that sponsored Maurice Strong, this Canadian who became such a powerful figure in the environmental movement, just passed away, I think, a year before David Rockefeller passed away. But it was through the environmental movement, raising the fear of environmental destruction or catastrophe if we don't establish international standards and do away with sovereignty and local control, because we need the oligarchs or their hired experts to manage things, to manage humanity, to manage control of resources. And they impose, so they start the World Wildlife Federation, these things, all these transnational organizations under the auspices of the UN to manage the world's resources. Of course, what they're doing is, it's not as if you have a disinterested group of philanthropic people or of experts running these things. It's an excuse to control the world's resources and absorb property to get control of things like water, farmland, conservation. They're warding off millions of acres, pushing people off the land or keeping people from controlling the land or exploiting the land or developing the land under the name of conservation. But that really what that's really doing is allowing the oligarchs to ultimately control the resources and in the process impoverish humanity.
Absolutely. And just kind of going back just a little bit, I would just point out that, like, if you look at the trajectory of the development of the birth control pill, mm-hmm. The Rockefellers were just they were the basically, you could call John D. the father of the birth control pill, because that foundation is what really set Sanger in motion and kept her going. Mm-hmm. And then with the Ford Foundation, they worked to both create the original birth control centers. They were grants given to all of these sites that were set up, to dispense it. And then they also bludgeoned the political response against the pill, because remember, particularly the Catholics at that time were opposed to it. They wanted to create legal structures against it and to closely regulate it. But there were so many people involved, but certainly the Rockefellers were a major power in not just the development of the pill, but then in pushing it to basically just be something that would be like a civil right, mm-hmm. Everyone would have access to. And then just think to the extent that that has changed demography, to change the population natures, it's changed everything in our country. And yet it wasn't something that was decided democratically. It was just the political power of the Rockefellers that actually forced the pill down our throat.
Yeah. And it's, again, also the secret society's hand can be seen there, because it's through the media, through Time Life, which is Henry Luce, that's Skull and Bones, promoting these things, the pill, promoting, the sexual revolution through, the Rockefeller Foundation funded the Kinsey's.
Exactly. See, this is the thing. they're able to, under the auspice of philanthropy, do more evil than they could ever do if they were just basically, hiring people and sort of like disclosing what the end result would be. You know, in other words, if you had the David's statement, and then he'd said, and to this end, I'm going to hire Kinsey to create, you know, now that never happens. You have the Rockefeller Foundation for, you know, reproductive rights. Mm-hmm. You have grants coming through the foundation. And then, of course, you know, with art, just like you say, it's all under the idea of art and benefit to the population. But then, you know, you look into it, and what do you really see? You see real art being impossible to find any purchase in our culture, because there's so much garbage that's just being paid for and funded and put out into American culture that comes through these guys. So, you know, the foundation has become far more evil than any human could ever be, because it can operate in so many levels.
Yeah, and I read that piece out of E. Michael Jones's book on Cardinal Kroll and the Cultural Revolution, talking about the foundations, how the foundations destroy self-government, elected yep. representative government, because it is a shadow government working behind the scenes, and they have malevolent purposes, but they have a structure or a plan how the foundation will grant money to a university or a think tank, which will produce a study that has the air of science to it, perhaps, or someone will write a book. It will grant money to a think tank to promote a certain policy or idea, a meme, get it out there. And of course, the same people who ultimately control the foundations control the press and the media that promote this. So they'll be directed to promote this, and so it gets in the public eye. And you have a study, you have the press reporting upon it, and then the government responds to it, citing the science behind the study and the support that's getting in the media, and lo and behold, it becomes policy. But ultimately, it's controlled at the center, and it's very Masonic in a way, but it's...
It is.
And it's the same way the CFR functions the same way, because they have guys, they have their guys and gals in the State Department. They have their guys and gals in the New York Times or Washington Post or Newsweek or the media, whatever, CNN, Fox, whatever. And they also have their guys in Hollywood, guys and gals in Hollywood, and there are guys and gals in industry in Madison Avenue, and they promote an agenda, and it's not very complicated if you think about it, and if you have the motive, means, and opportunity, it's very easy to do, and they have the means because they control the money.
Yeah, and so this is, you can see that actually what you're really dealing with is mind control, because if they were basically honestly representing their political goal and trying to achieve it through the political system where there would be disclosure and process and debate, I mean, a lot of this stuff would just be stopped in its tracks. But the problem is they don't come at it that way. They come at it from, well, we're a foundation, we're charity, we're you know, if you look at anti-fertility vaccines, mm-hmm. right? Just take an example. Okay, so if that had been attempted through political means, it could never have been something that would have been accepted by, for example, like in India. If you look at like how the vaccine was tested, set into motion, the World Health Organization promoted it. It all came from Rockefeller Foundation developed vaccines for a mass scale fertility reduction, mm-hmm. right? This never hit the political system. You see what I'm saying? Yeah. Is that they are able to completely, when they say they're a shadow government, good heavens. I mean, democracy is a shadow government. I mean, the Rockefellers are basically the way, and their society, the secret society. I mean, they are so completely overt in the power now, right? Where they're able to simply develop something like their mass scale fertility vaccines.
Yeah, if
Not,
I
no one's ever voted on this. No one, no, no one, no one. We don't even get to see any studies done. I believe there was one vaccine that they only had, wasn't only tested on like 120 women or something, and they declared it safe. And the next thing you know, it was being given out in the millions, right?
Yeah, and it's like if you went to a bar and were caught slipping Mickeys in people's drinks, you'd be prosecuted.
Yeah.
Right? But they can sterilize, a third of Puerto Rican women?
Yeah.
Against their will or unwittingly do that and no one be prosecuted? Or you have the case with the tetanus shots that the World Health Organization was doing. I think you're alluding to that, how it was laced with a hormone which causes women to miscarry. It didn't happen accidentally, and no one was held accountable for it.
Exactly. You see, this is the thing, and then it's because it comes through these foundations and organizations like WHO, which is this global coordinating body that has kind of extraordinary communications with things like the EU, even to our medical system. They have ways to circumvent any kind of participation of democracy in these processes. And more it's becoming overt in my mind. More and more you're seeing the foundations are create agendas, which there are huge organizations like WHO that they can work with. And man, democracy is just on the outside looking in. We never get a single chance, even if you end up with something as catastrophic as the mass vaccine disaster in India, there's no accountability. No one is even charged with any crimes or anything. So, one thing that would be useful would be to try to bring all of the foundations, starting with the Rockefeller Foundation, into some kind of control by democracy.
That was attempted in the 50s with the Reese Committee and the book Renee Wormser, Foundations and Their Power.
Yeah.
But that was that book details how it was shut down.
Yeah, right, exactly. I'm hoping it would be nice if there's enough evidence now for, I think, another attack at this. Tim, I've been looking just for something to try to coalesce all of the sort of alt media energy around, something that's actually doable that, can be, can capture the imagination of not just kind of alt media characters, but just college students and humanist and religious people who have seen their culture destroyed. And I've wondered if this could be something that might be considered, because even though it failed in the 50s, at this point the foundations are so anti-democratic and I think are so well vetted as being fascistic that maybe, what do you think? Is that something that might capture the imagination of someone, or is it just,
it might gain some traction in the informed public, which is unfortunately a minority. I don't think the political process, it's kind of funny how much even as late as 1950s, how much independence there was remaining within the political process, like Congress could have these things. I mean, the fact that they ever had a hearing like this. But I think the phenomenon of McCarthyism and the Red Scare in the 50s, these things, a lot of that, they didn't know what they were looking at. They didn't know the enemy. You got to know your enemy in order to fight it. They thought they were fighting communism. And in a sense, they war at a certain level, because Alger Hiss was indeed a communist. But Alger Hiss, first and foremost, was a member of the elite. He was a lieutenant for the elite, just for one faction of it, whereas the Dulles brothers were a different faction of the same elite.
Wisdom itself, Tim, that is wisdom itself. No. This is like the key insight is to realize that the political theater that we see of as, Democrats, Republicans, communists, capitalists, these are just structures that are given to us so that we don't notice that there are strings attached to our politicians, all of them, and we don't look beyond this dramatic play that's taking place now, you know, like with, you know, Trump and Stormy Daniels, or or even with, you know, the historical one between, you know, like Alger Hiss and the commies that were going to, you know, infiltrate America and take us over. Look, it was the oligarchs who were organized that were really the danger at that time. And they've gone forward and are now creating a technologic slave state. And the population is not well informed about it. They're still being distracted by things that are, you know, just that are just created for them to move their attention away. And the Rockefellers would be, you know, I think a portal, right, into the group that actually controls. Yeah. So,
well, you know, Whitaker Chambers and the pumpkin patch story is so interesting. So, you know, it's a nice story about Alger Hiss. Yeah. But, you know, yeah, it was theater. But yeah, I mean, a good example of that, you're talking about false left, right. And of course, we were Americans in the 1950s were told that communism, was the enemy. They're coming to get us. Mao had China had fallen. Why did it fall? Was it communism that did this? Well, of course, Mao, as you alluded to earlier, Mao was an asset of the OSS and ultimately the Rockefellers. And it was a long-term plan, to, fundamentally change, China, to get to the point where China is today, is sort of this industrial workhouse or factory for the world of cheap labor. It's sort of, it's a Rockefeller's dream how Chinese society is operated, sort of this technocratic order. But he, I mean, in 1973, this is what he said about Mao. He goes, whatever, this is David Rockefeller in the New York Times. He goes, whatever the price of the Chinese Revolution, it has obviously succeeded not only in producing more efficient and dedicated administration, but also in fostering high morale and community of purpose. The social experiment in China under Chairman Mao's leadership is one of the most important and successful in human history. Mao is a great man. So that's David Rockefeller. This is after what, like, I think a conservative estimate is Mao's policies killed about 40 million Chinese.
Well, that statement was after the Cultural Revolution.
Yeah.
I mean, this is like literally, this is insanity squared. The idea that, you know, well, look at the morale is great. Yeah. I mean, it's great when you have a slave state and there's a gun at your head and you go to work because of it, that the morale is great. I don't think so. I think that's just a propaganda piece. So this is, I was unaware of that. I knew that Mao had a relationship with Yale. I thought he had attended classes, but when I learned that he'd actually was a staffer to Geoffrey Rockefeller, I knew that the extent he was just a controlled piece. The other family that Rockefellers in the East, in the Asiatic East, that the Rockefellers have a strong relationship with is, guess what? The royal family of Japan.
Yes.
David.
Well, Sony, Standard Oil of New York, right?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I'm talking about the emperor.
Yes. Yes.
David goes and spends his weekends together, and so, you know, you just look at kind of a hidden world government, which is becoming less and less hidden. And so, you know, one, I think, important thing to remember is that, you know, there have always been these ideas that you have basically one banking system. Okay. Mm-hmm. So, and then there's different ways that it's hidden. And people have made the claim that the Rockefellers are basically inside the Rothschild banking world, that they're either agents or related. Some people have speculated that they're actually relative. Well, you know, one piece of evidence in this regard is that about, 4 years ago, a little known fact, the Rockefellers sold basically 40% of their legal entity that controls their money to the Rothschild family. So the Rothschilds received 40% of the shares, and they gave them a couple $1 billion. And I don't know the exact details, but it was some huge money. And they ended up with this one single financial entity. So People have speculated that really what you saw was just the coming out of the closet, that the idea that the two families were distinct was an illusion. And now, because they feel that, you know, the time has come where they don't even need to maintain it anymore. And so they actually created this a legal structure so that the two families are able to basically be one financial entity at this point.
Yeah, yeah. But it seems like the Rothschilds have played a more, they've stayed further behind the scenes, whereas the Rockefellers have gotten the banking, the business, even the politics.
Yeah.
You had Winthrop in Arkansas. You had, of course, there's Nelson Rockefeller, governor of New York and vice president of the United States, virtue of Watergate. And if Squeaky Fromm had been a better shot, perhaps president of the United States. His ascendancy was very interesting with Watergate. Now, some people see that ultimately as a CIA Rockefeller plot to get, you know, to push Nixon aside. Of course, the Bush angle is important there because it was Prescott Bush who gave Nixon his start in politics, which is interesting. But they've kind of some have gotten business and finance and politics. It's interesting, that both New York and Arkansas, these states, and West Virginia, West Virginia and Arkansas, it's funny, these mountainous states, that's good for smuggling, isn't it? And of course, the port of New York, and they have governor that's interesting. Some people have speculated that Winthrop Rockefeller is the real father of Bill Clinton, but that's it's like the Aleister Crowley thing.
It'd be interesting, right? But
yeah,
a little difficult to prove with the data we have. Yeah.
Now, have you? What's interesting is, of course, in New York, you have World Trade Center. Those two buildings were called the David and the Nelson, because it was Nelson Rockefeller,
yeah,
David Rockefeller, who facilitated that deal with the New York Port Authority to build those monstrosities in the 1960s and early 1970s. And have you seen that? I think it was a cover of Newsweek, 1968 or 67, with David Rockefeller on the cover. And I guess it's about the construction of these buildings at the time. And he's on the cover, and he's standing at his desk, and there's a big window behind him, and it's overlooking the Manhattan skyline, and where the Twin Towers will be one day. And it says the new era in banking. And if you look closely at his watch... The watch,
yeah, 911,
9-1-9 and the 11. So, but they're, yeah. So that's an old thing. They were, Rockefeller's very important, played a big role in getting those buildings built. So that's an interesting story in and of itself, right there.
But I think we can at this point we can assume that the buildings were created with the idea of the destructions, that it has a symbolic, mm-hmm. Their destruction had a symbolic meaning to the secret society. Last week I speculated about the Coen brothers, having a foreshadowing of 9-1-1. And in fact, I my memory wasn't perfect, but it was correct. They did.
Yeah, it was a check in the Big Lebowski.
A check, yeah. 9-1-1 was written on it. Yeah. And so, but the point is that so 9-1-1 basically was understood by people inside the society that this was the date that they were going to, basically bring out the new world order, right? This was going to lead to the final creation of Eretz Israel, because you'd have the cover for the Middle East wars, and also to the technologic snooping slave state in the European world, because now you'd have nonstop war against terror, right? So you'd have both parts of the plan would be, originated with this date. And so all of the foreshadowing, I think it's really valuable because we can see who's inside the deal.
Yeah, right? And you look at the main beneficiaries, these immediate beneficiaries of those attacks, was apparently this sort of this Jewish cabal of crooks who control the New York Port Authority, New York and New Jersey Port Authority. Yeah. Of course, one who's very closely related to the current president of the United States, the Kushner family.
Yes, oddly enough,
Of course, and now apparently...
I guess he's not going to drain the swamp.
If you look at foreign policy, at least, it's being controlled by, by Sheldon Adelson, apparently. So, who apparently gave him $30 million. I thought he wasn't going to take money, but he did. And so now, that's why, our embassy's in Jerusalem, and, and No one's talking about the 100, protesters who were being slaughtered. Who were slaughtered by the.
Isn't that odd? Now Trump is see. So this is, it gets. You can see the organization. I think it's possible. I think it's impossible not to see it at this point. And the idea that Trump was going to be distinct from the organization. I mean, people had that belief for just being silly. He was clearly selected. So we have a control of our political system. The Rockefellers, are representing a point in the fictional drama, but they also seem to have really true power inside the system.
Oh, yeah. That's basically a good illustration of that is 1976 and Jimmy Carter, who was pretty much a Rockefeller creation. Of course, he was posing as an outsider as well. And maybe in some respects, he thought he was the governor of Georgia. But it was Brzezinski who brought Carter to David Rockefeller's attention. Brzezinski himself was handpicked from Rockefeller out of Columbia University to start the Trilateral Commission.
Right.
And so it was a meeting, I think, in 1975, 76 at the Tarrytown Estate, where Rockefeller decided that Jimmy Carter would be the next president of the United States. And once he was selected by Rockefeller, Jimmy Carter was on his way to the nomination. All of a sudden, the newspapers and magazines started talking about Jimmy Carter. And they even
overnight sensation.
Yeah, and they
Martin
literally
they King, Gloria Steinem. I mean, it's just amazing, isn't it?
Yeah, and they were instructed to try to make him look like Jack Kennedy.
and it was I always thought that was so amazing that people didn't realize. I mean, can you imagine a less charismatic and interesting personality than Jimmy Carter?
I cannot.
I mean, it's impossible, and yet he was an overnight sensation. I remember, I lived through that. I mean, I was scratching my head, going, "This guy looks like Howdy Doody, and he has like one of the worst speaking voices I've ever heard. Why is he being promoted by everyone? You couldn't turn on the TV set without seeing, they did Carter this, Carter that.
The malaise was part of the plan. The oil shocks. This is important. Now, Carter didn't. I mean, a lot of what Carter had to deal with wasn't his doing. He was dealing with the headache of the Nixon shocks and the Vietnam War and these things. But this is how it plays out. So they needed Carter to be a fall guy to get to the next phase. which was Reagan, who served a different function.
Okay, but tying back to the Rockefellers, I don't know if you. There was a recent WikiLeaks revelation. I forget when it was. It was a while back, but. It showed that during the transition in Iran, when the Ayatollah took over, one of the key problems, diplomatic problems for the West, was what was going to happen to the Shah.
Mm-hmm.
And so Kissinger then created a back channel with real power to try to determine, who's going to take him in. It wasn't with Carter. It was with David Rockefeller.
It was Kissinger's decision. Yeah,
Jimmy wasn't even in the loop. I mean, the WikiLeaks are absolutely quite shocking.
Well, they asked Carter, "Who told you to do it?" He said, "Oh, Kissinger did."
Right.
Well, who's Kissinger work for? Right. Yeah. I mean, Kissinger was always, even when he worked for when he was with Nixon, he was Nixon's handler for the Rockefellers, and he became. There was a trade-off. Kissinger was sort of like a Republican. Brzezinski was a Democrat, that sort of thing. But here he is advising. Of course, if you really took a look at that whole Iranian the hostage crisis itself, how that was kind of set up, and the taking in the Shah. Of course, this precipitates the storming of the embassy and the seizure of the hostages and these things. And of course, that the U.S. government responds by seizing Iranian assets. That there were, of course, all that money that the Shah when the Shah sold his oil, of course, he had to sell it in dollars, which is another Rockefeller plan, right? The petrodollar system.
Sure.
In 1973, in the Yom Kippur War, which Kissinger fomented to usher that in. And, of course, that's a Bilderberg plan. That's the Yom Kippur War was there to cause the oil shocks, a 400% spike in oil prices, which turned a lot of oil production projects profitable overnight. It also established the petrodollar and it saved the dollar because the dollar just 2 years before had been severed from gold. So when they established a petrodollar, it created, international demand for the dollars, because people wanted, because countries, in order to get oil, had to purchase dollars. So it kept the dollar going. It kept the dollar going as a world reserve currency. But it shoot ahead to 1979 is that the seizing of the embassy gave the U.S. the pretext to seize Iranian assets, which had been banked during the Shah regime, which perhaps the revolutionary government might withdraw from. What bank?
Yeah.
Chase Manhattan Bank.
Chase Manhattan. Chase
Bank. So there you go. And to this day, the assets, I think, are still in the bank there. While the Rockefellers so dastardly as to, let 52 American citizens held hostage for 444 days so they can control the assets, I don't think.
Well,
it's
they also were able to jack the oil price up.
Yes.
The way I look at it, in my opinion, is that, you have, they have what's called Saudi oil, right, which became really the sole, point where oil was coming to the West from after the Iranians were kicked out. But if you look at ownership, they talk about the Saudi royal family, but look a little deeper, please. And what you'll see is that Standard Oil and BP and all of the and Shell, they're the ones that are actually owning most of this oil. They're the ones that make most of the money on it. Mm-hmm. And so they basically, with the fake, in my opinion, I think Khomeini was their agent, but that's just me. I can't prove that. That's just, and the reason I believe that is just because everything just worked so logically and so perfect for them. Then now you have the petrodollar. This will then keep the Federal Reserve System afloat, because the dollar won't go to zero since it's the only thing you can buy oil with. And there won't be any alternative for the oil that is controlled by the families, because now the major surplus of oil in the world is going to be completely controlled by Bilderberg oil companies. And then you have the back channel stuff showing that this group is even in control of where the Shah's family is going to be placed.
Mm-hmm. Are you suggesting the U.S. government or U.S. Western intelligence agencies would fake a revolution in Iran? When have they ever done that?
When do they ever lie? I mean, it's the whole thing in the Middle East. I've been beating this drum, Tim, for, I'm in a drum circle, and it just keeps going on and on. But for years, I've been saying, look, the Middle East wars are completely fake. This is just geopolitics. They're just all of the confusion about the U.S. foreign policy and about the different terrorist organizations, ISIS, Hamas. There's no reality to any of this. The real situation is that the Palestinians are being genocided. The countries that were mentioned by the group that produced the Project of New American Century, then they came up with that other paper where it outlined, the full spectrum dominance. This is the plan, and everything that's occurring in, that we see in newspapers and the details and the drama, this is all just complete nonsense. The plan is to push out the Muslims, expand Israel, and just retain control over all the oil that moves around in that area. And you have what I'm afraid are, lifetime actors. Like, I do not trust Assad. I don't trust Putin's participation in this. Now, I know this is deep paranoia for some people, but that's just how I honestly see it.
Yeah, I think ultimately the Iranian revolution, I think, was fomented. I mean, I can't see how, Western intelligence agencies would leave Khomeini alone in Paris for so many years. And
yes,
he's able to, I mean, who's distributing, making these tapes? Apparently he made all these cassette tapes, lectures, and he had them distributed throughout Iran, and this caused a revolution. You look at the Savat itself, the Shah secret police, the one that caused so much resentment. The Shah didn't control the Savat; it was the CIA.
Exactly right. And so it's like I would say the same thing to the Iranians that I would say to the Chinese, is that you have a real problem. You have a secret society problem that you are not aware of.
Mm-hmm.
And it led you through into this insanity of the Marxists and then the Politburo. The political power is not being distributed to the population. It is a secret society. They do have some connection. It's clear as a bell when you see Mao's relationship into the Rockefeller family, right? I mean, how clear can that? How clear can it possibly get?
With the Bolsheviks in Russia, their ties
and the Bolsheviks, exactly. So it's this is the plan has been by an organization for a long time. How long, I don't know, but certainly before the 20th century began and before the 19th century began. This group is international, it's organized, and it has achieved a kind of world domination.
Yeah, through banking and finance, and that's kind of what Carol Quigley talks about, through global finance, through financing mechanism, they were to establish, in effect, a world government. And that's what they're, you can see this being a kind of strategy being rolled out or executed with the Rockefellers in the United States, with the getting control of industry, then moving into finance and banking, and then setting up a banking system where they control the currency, and then they can gradually sort of take over the economy that way by controlling the flow of money and credit. At the same time, so they control banking, they control energy, they move into agriculture. And they move into things
and pharmaceuticals
and health, yeah. And all these things become sort of methods of extraction and exploitation of the general public. And you see it gradually through their control and through their concentration of wealth, is sort of a reordering, or perhaps a reintroduction of sort of a, I guess you could say, sort of a neo-feudalistic order. That's how they see things.
It's the technological feudalism.
Yeah,
but the problem is. Is that I think that Huxley has given us the clearest picture of the Rockefeller, Rothschild future, yeah. Which is it's a broad stroke world where certain groups are going to be controlled intellectually. They will have a level of intellect like the Delta and Epsilons that Huxley talked about. Mm-hmm. And so when you look at the Rockefellers and you see they're plugged into eugenics, into vaccines, into pharmaceuticals, man, this is really troubling.
Yeah, the same people that want to reduce the human population are financing all the research in medical research. Does that trouble you?
Yeah. Well, how about the fact that so much of the medicine that they put out neuters populations that could produce healthy, vigorous humans, and creates humans that are weak, feeble, and autistic. I mean, this is even more troubling than greed and all these other motivations. It's when you look at that kind of application, right? And I think at this point it's a plausible conjecture. Right, there's just so much evidence that there's malfeasance inside the medical industry, and all of it is being, so much of it is being controlled by oligarch families. That, it's a little diffuse now, but at one point you could look at Rockefeller and Rothschild family controlling so much of the pharmaceutical industry. They're, I think now they're kind of selling to different groups, try to hide a little bit, but at one point you could see what was going on. It was just overt. And so the fact that these industries are taking us into illness, to weakness, to autism, I mean, my God, you really have to wake up and try to, find the energy in yourself to help us with this research project, right? And help us to spread the word about this, because we really want to start resisting before you have a situation where half of the children born are autistic.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And one trend you do see, or at least theme you see, is control. Control. That's that they're obsessed on controlling things. And they're using things like environmental extremism or environmental fear mongering.
Yeah, population boom, and then we'll
Prince Charles
resources in the world. So it's a crisis. We have to get the population down.
You have like David Rothschild, this Jesus-like figure, right? Who yachts around the world, and I don't know how many yachts he owns, how many houses he owns.
On the plastiki.
Yeah, and you have like Prince Charles talking about how we're going to have drastic changes in how we live. We are really,
Yeah,
Charles, you're going to give up a few of your manors. I don't know, a few of your castles. And what they've done with this sort of, this is the a lot of the excuses under the I guess the pretext of efficiency and monitoring, because you need smart technology to monitor how much energy you use. So everything has to be monitored in your house. So you have the Internet of Things in your house, that's going to monitor everything you do, because everything you do is going to consume energy. And so you're only going to allow to consume so much. It's not going to be based on what you're willing to pay for. It's going to be based on things like some sort of carbon credit or something, that you're allowed a certain amount a day or a month or whatever. And it's all going to seem very voluntary at first, and then as they, pretty soon it won't be voluntary anymore. But that's
Exactly.
right out of the technocracy playbook that's in the 1930s. But apparently, they seem to have picked it up in the 70s and started pushing with the Club of Rome and these things and the sort of the technocratic orders. That's what Brzezinski wrote about, and using again the crisis atmosphere. Fear, of environmental catastrophe. So everything has to be managed. It's international, so we can't have things like sovereignty. We can't have things like representative government. The world's gonna have to be managed by smart people, the smart people who are ultimately whose salaries are paid for by the oligarchs, and they're gonna say all the right things,
Yeah, the population won't even know they've been enslaved.
No, they those live in a smart city
Yep.
where everything's monitored.
With your self-driving car and your internet that records all of your communication, all of your banking, all of your purchases, where you're, and then of course with now with the smart car and the self-driving car, which will all be monitored, you will literally be in a world that is 100% monitored. And of course, because of that, 100% controlled.
But Joe, then if obviously if the smart computer is setting your thermostat for you, then you don't have to worry about that anymore, right?
Right. You don't have to worry about a thing because you're no longer in existence. You see, this is, but it's sort of like I was talking to someone about the self-driving car, and they were all in favor of it, and I said, yeah, it's a great feature, but the problem is, it's not a very far step from that to the government is the entity driving the car, right? Because a Mercedes now has a car that they're coming out with, six passenger, which has no steering wheel. I mean, it's not theoretical. And so you are just a passenger. That's it. And now you at first you will have the controls. You say, take me to the airport or whatever. But remember, this is all well. This can all be monitored. And if the computer says no, you're not allowed to go to the airport, what are you going to do? You see, because you don't have a car with a steering wheel anymore. So even though it's a crude kind of example, I think it's one that people need to be aware of. And this is like. Our discussion tonight is sort of like, we it always comes back to kind of similar themes, and really the reason for that is because what is happening is the building out of the schematic again, and you can you plug the Rockefellers in and you see how they subvert democracy and circumvent democracy with their foundations. And when you look in back of the family, you see, the genocide, the control, the pharmaceutical dumbing down of the populations, the eugenics. I mean, it's a very ugly picture, right? In back of them, it plugs into the schematic of the building out of this technologic slave state, and the whole purpose for, we are building out the schematic is just to help people have awareness of it so they can resist. If we know about it, if we, lose our intimidation of talking about these things, then hopefully we can find the energy to come up with really good ways of resisting the conclusion of the building out of the schematic. I mean, the picture that you're referring to, Rockefeller with the 911 watch. I mean, really? Does anyone really think that could be circumstance? But you see, that means that they really are that evil, that they really are into sacrifice of not just, you know, the individuals they need to remove for political expediency and finance. Man, they are into just population reshaping, right?
Well, that's what, you know, the Reese Committee hearing, Norman Dodds, chief investigator, Catherine Casey, discovered back as early as 1909 when she had access to the minutes of the... it was, they determined that war was the principal way, the best way to fundamentally change society, and they got war. And so, that, you know, that's, I mean, if you're willing to wage war just to achieve some sort of social engineering scheme and have all those millions of men die, people die, you're willing to do anything, I mean, to achieve your agenda. And that's what we're dealing
that's what
with
we're
here.
Up. And there is no humanity. There are dividing lines, and the question is, what are they? What, how do you know you're on the side that isn't, you know, going to be wiped out? When you look at the Rockefellers, you remember you were talking about how, you know, no one really can quite figure out how John D, you know, got all these fancy deals with railroad shipping that gave him an edge. I mean, how Standard Oil monopoly was created is really buried deep. I tried to look into this, and you could see a lot of people were complaining. If you look at the newspaper articles, and there was some journalism that was trying to be done at that time, and everyone was worried about it. They didn't quite know how it was, but somehow it wasn't just the railroads, though that was the primary cost that he was better. But he had ways of getting everything cheaper. He was producing it just... the reason he became a monopoly is because he could basically, it was like the Federal Reserve. I mean, it would be like, how do you compete against the Federal Reserve in like selling credit when they don't have any cost of it, right? I mean, it's impossible. It's a monopoly. Well, somehow he got a monopoly established, and it was under very mysterious circumstances, which I think now, with the participation of the Rockefellers and the secret society, you can see that there was just basically a shadow market that was created that drove this family into their position of financial power. But remember, he was working with Harriman in the railroads. Okay, very well established. Harriman and Rockefellers had some kind of relationship because they were getting, and the Bush family, they were getting these premium deals for shipping of oil. Now, bear in mind, if you go forward just a generation, you get Montague Norman working with Brown Brothers, his family's investment bank, merging with Harriman Brothers, the descendant company, which has all of the wealth that had been, much of it which had been generated, their investment banking. This then is being Brown Brothers Harriman with Prescott Bush, right? The next generation up. And now they're going to be shipping money to Hitler to develop, the Nazi Party. I mean, this is how serious and dangerous the relationship that these families have is.
And Standard Oil would play a key role in supplying much-needed aviation fuel to the German Air Force.
Amen.
You know, gotta keep the war going. You know,
right? But see, so what we're looking at is basically a death machine, right? For Europeans, I mean. The whole structure, it looks fake, right? How can all these relationships just be for money when it all ends up with World War II?
Yeah.
I don't buy it. So that's why the Rockefellers are just another piece of the schematic. I don't see them. I mean, I think that, you know, the way they acquired the money is – to me, just looks fake. The way that then they created the foundation, which just accidentally funded every malevolent thing in the planet. I think this, of course, under the auspice of charity, this is fake. I think the whole family is fake, Tim. I think they're lifetime actors. That's what I think. And that's why I don't buy anything they say about their background. I don't buy their background any more than I buy how John D. became, because of his business acumen, he got this monopoly going for oil in the United States. I think it's all BS.
Yeah, I mean, it is rather self-serving, and you think in a competitive economy with so many people, how could he become so dominant without something else,
I think it's
pushing it?
impossible.
And you, I think you do get a hint at his beneficial his treatment by the railroads, which was a big boon, and which of course that traces back to Harriman and the financing and banking, and of course his initial funding. I think the official story has it from the National City Bank in Cleveland, which I believe was with a Rothschild bank. And again, when you're dealing with banking and finance, even in the 1860s or 1870s, you would have to deal with the Rothschilds. And the Rothschilds, it's not, it goes unreported, they played a big part in the formation, at least the path that the United States took. It's you've August Belmont, who was, I think he promoted Manifest Destiny, which is ultimately bigger than the railroads. It was, I think it was, he, the Rothschilds were very influential in the outbreak of the American, so-called American Civil War. So was the Secret Society, Freemasonry on both sides. You also have, you mentioned that the Rock, David Rockefeller was very friendly with the Japanese Emperor. And of course, it was Commodore Perry in 1859 or 54, I forget, 1850s, that he's the one that showed up with his gunboats in Tokyo Bay to pry Japan open to so-called trade, as they call it. But this was so this penetration of Japan, and this was what caused Japan ultimately to modernize in the 18 after the 1860s. And become sort of an industrial nation, which for several years was sort of like was like the cat's paw of Anglo-American policy in Asia vis-a-vis China, and of course that phase ended with the 19 late 1920s and 30s when Japan became the bad guy. But Commodore Perry's daughter, if I'm not mistaken, married August Belmont, who was reportedly an illegitimate child of the Rothschild of.
Right, exactly right. And then, look out one business partner and look at August Belmont's joint ownership of the New York Times with Jerome. His daughter then goes across the pond and marries Winston Churchill's father. What a shock. Right. And so then you mean these Rothschilds are interesting because they cast a long shadow, don't they?
And this is why the Rothschilds are always loaning money to Churchill's father.
Well, of course, but see, but just think about it, because you've got, on Belmont is helping, he was helping to fund railroads and Harriman. I mean, the money is if you look at like how this money is being circulated, this then is helping J.D. Rockefeller. They're buying up the media, New York Times, and then they're also spawning the Winnie the Pooper, right, who's one generation out, so they can have the Holocaust of Dresden and Hamburg, right, where you have millions of Gentiles burned to death. So, gee, I mean, history unfolded, but in a very specific and orderly way. You see, when you start seeing that such a small group all connected back into these banking families. These strange relationships between the Jewish banking families and Masons, because if you look into the Churchill family, I mean, it's one of the premier and oldest Masonic families in Britain, but moreover, I mean, it's proto-Zionism, because with when you've got Palmerston coming up with the idea that it's time now in 1842 or 1844 that we've got to reestablish Israel because the Jews want to go back. Right, even though there wasn't a single Jew in Europe that was making the decision, it was this British supposedly Gentile Freemason who is so worried about humanity. Right, I mean, look at his how concerned he was about the coolies in China. Look at Palmerston's great concern in humanity for the Irish Catholics, right, during potato genocide. Right, this is the guy who now suddenly goes, gee whiz. We just care so much about these Jewish people. We've got to reestablish, because this is just an example of his humanism. Well, see, to me, analytically, if you start going backwards and then you see, well, coming across the pond is Jerome's daughter, and then this family, which was part of Palmerston's circus, so-called, that then, you know, it creates Zionism. How could this, you know, precise group then structure, be so much part of the structure of World War II, which then leads amazingly to the conclusion of Palmerston's vision, where the Israel can now be established because you've got the Jews wanting to go back, right, since there's all this anti-Semitism. Mm-hmm. And you also have the greatest anti-Semite in history, who now has created the Holocaust, which will create this political structure whereby you can't really contest any of this stuff, leading today to the tragic situation, Tim, where the Palestinians can be shot down, including women and children, by snipers, and yet it isn't even a news story.
No, because if you point that out, you obviously, you're an anti-Semitic.
Exactly.
You know, and the ADL will make sure you lose your job.
Well, they'll censor our YouTube production.
Yes, they'll work with YouTube and it's censored. Yes, the true father of Israel, which is Adolf Hitler.
Right.
So, but yeah, it's funny how the British really took up the Zionist cause just when Winston Churchill was converting the British Navy to oil.
I mean, it's amazing, isn't it, how it's all kind of fitting together into this big structure. And so, you know, it's a schematic. And I don't think it's when you get enough details on the table and can link them together. I just don't see how what is in back of the process by which we call history is there's any question about. And unfortunately, I don't see the future of where it takes us as unclear either.
No. Well, the Rockefellers, they're not just a family, right?
They're a way of life, so. And a very, very evil one. And so, you know, I in my little world here, I don't use the oil products. I have an electric car, but not a self-driving one. and I don't take the pharmaceutical products either. No chemicals. I'm not interested in putting any of that stuff in my body. Do I know what I'm doing? Hell no. I have no idea. I only know I don't want any of that crap. That's what I know.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to be part of the, like, where I have to give them money every time I want to use the car. I have a solar system. I don't buy the electricity from the grid. I have a big solar system and, panels, you know, solar panels. And mm-hmm. so I use that electricity for my car. And I have a deal with other people of a like mind so that if I travel, I can use their electricity because I'm very fastidious about this.
Mm-hmm.
That's peculiar, but I really don't like to participate in the oil system. I wish I could use the planes that I didn't, you know, have to give them money for, but unfortunately I have to. So anyway, there it is, Tim. The Rockefeller.
Okay. There it is. So, all right.
Thank you so much.
Enjoy the weekend.
All right.
Next week. Take it easy. Bye-bye.